So we start now a discussion here on the panel for about 20 minutes, and then there are possibilities of questions, comments from you. I would like to start with the language you use, Luc Stiels. You speak about language, you speak about concept of the self. Here we see how a computer or a machine is developing a concept of the self. And at the same time, from the outside, it looks a bit very simple what the machines are doing. What is your method to find out that this idea of concept of the self applies to the machine? And the whole, what does the whole language about language we use normally related to humans, in which way does it relate really to machines?
Yes, well, of course, it's in a way, it's when we talk about these machines, when we try to understand what they do, we use language that we use among us. You know, we talk about seeing. The robot sees the red ball. And now, is this? It's not the same way of seeing. But there is a functional equivalence. So it's like an airplane, you know, is flying. We say the airplane flies. Of course, it doesn't fly like a bird. It doesn't flap with wings and things like that. So it's a, but the principles, underlying principles are similar, and the function is the same. That's why we use the same terminology. And so in the case of the self, you know, it's actually extraordinarily complicated and dynamic, because there is no little cell or something, no simple explanation for it. You know, the self is, you have the body, you have the persona that you create, and all these kinds of things. And the body is then also the sensory experience, is the control, proprioception, you know, all these kinds of things together. And so this is the big message, actually. It may look simple what we do, but if you start probing, then it turns out to be extraordinarily complex. So it's a bit like in biology, you know, when they started in biology to realize that we were dealing with chemical systems and with very complex molecules in the beginning. Julia knows this better. You know, the biologists didn't want to believe it, because they say it cannot be, that's such a complex thing, you know. But the more they are probing, the complexity of biology is just incredible. And it's in a similar thing, that the complexity of language, for example, we have at least 500,000 grammatical constructions in our head. We are dealing with millions of concepts, millions of facts. You know, and in AI today, we build systems that also contain millions of facts and have all these grammatical constructions and things like that. So it's a good tool to handle the complexity, which is a defining characteristic of our mind.
And why did not your form of AI being developed now, let's say, in the world of social media, but this kind of pattern recognition you started to analyze?
Well, there are many reasons for it, but the main one is, if there's always a gap or a lag, if you want, of 10 to 20 years between invention or creation of new ideas and their use. So what we now see, like deep learning, for example, are things which are basically dating from the 80s. And so now they are possible with more computing power, more data, things like that. So now, you know, it explodes. But these basic ideas, they were already there 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So the things that I'm talking about, this is for within 25 years. And I'm convinced that in the future AI within 20 years, let's say, will be a dynamic, evolutionary, embodied, you know, all of these things. Because otherwise, it's dangerous not to do that. Because those systems do not have meaning. So they are dangerous.
Hito, in her talk, was basically analyzing the relationship between AI and, or one aspect of the her talk was about the relationship between AI and society, in which it is transforming society. And my question to Hito would be, could you imagine that there are not the same shadows or other shadows to this kind of interpretation of AI?
No, I mean, I was very charmed to hear you talking about robots which have no purpose, right? I mean, they just play. It's very hard to understand me if you're sitting. I also had a hard time understanding you, but I really like when you said these robots, they don't have any purpose except they have free time. And I think that's exactly the contrary of what is happening, you know. Robots in society have anything but free time. So they are always there for a purpose, and the purpose is usually efficiency and maximization of profit, period. Or making things more cheaper. That's usually the purpose. So of course, I mean, you know, my idea has been for quite a while that I find it extremely fascinating, you know, all the experiments with machine learning or artificial life simulations and whatnot, but you have to basically quarantine them in a gallery, period, for the next 100 years or so, until people or robots have figured out what actually is the case, you know, what happens, what this is all about, what meaning is, or other questions. I'm sure there is, you know, millions of questions which could be explored in this time. But the thing that happens is that this is tested, as they say, in the wild, meaning the purpose is established while already implementing it in reality, within reality. And then, you know, with the implementation, the further optimization and so on of these processes is explored, and that's what happens. So I think there are two different kinds. And for me, you know, I cannot answer the question what a machine is, what machine learning is, what artificial intelligence is. I think no one can. But it's very obvious what these things are doing already. And even, as I said, in their very low-tech forms. And I'm particularly, I mean, worried does not even capture it, terrorized to imagine what happens in this precise political situation with the rise of all these authoritarian movements and leaders, what is going to happen with AI, but also automation, right? Just to give you an example, one of the things that happens now with Brexit, of course, is that many of the big warehouses and so on that were relying on cheap Eastern European laborers, they are not going to hire, of course, British laborers now. They are going to use more robots. So robots and automation will help isolationism, will help the creation of borders within the next decade or so. And I don't even want to go into, you know, how machine learning could facilitate those developments.
The question is also, when you started your experiments in the 90s, we were still in another world. At the moment, evidently, this kind of artificial intelligence based on pattern recognition is transforming our world to an extent that, for example, concepts such as information, communication, and that was also meant in the video of Hito, are being transformed, even up to the point where one can question, will be the concept of the self in 20 years when one applies your kind of concept of learning and AI, would that be the same than today? Or are the technologies at the moment so interruptive that they really transform really our basic notions of self, communication, information.
Well, there are two things that I want to say about this. One is that, you see, AI itself, I mean, the people who do AI are very practical. I mean, they just have a problem, like recognizing the sound of whether a glass is breaking or not. Or there's a painting machine, you know, and then that if there's a bubble of air in the paint, then it doesn't work properly, and things like that. So really problems, concrete problems, and how to deal with them. And so most of the work in AI is very far removed from all those considerations. Now, having said that, it is true that if AI starts to be used, and particularly, I would say, misused in certain areas, and I think an example which I wanted to communicate is in social media, you know, how people are being manipulated, actually.
Perhaps you can say a few words about that, in which way AI is manipulating today.
Well, it's of course, it's implicitly manipulating, but basically well, let's make it very concrete. So you're in YouTube and you're watching a clip, so you search for the clip, you see the clip, but on the side you see also other clips. And so, because what YouTube wants is for you to stay in YouTube, the same thing with Instagram, you know, and so on. And so the owners of the platforms, they want to stay, that you stay within their platform. And so they have machine learning that is basically trying to determine what is the best ranking to present to you so that you would click on it. And so, of course, there are millions, I don't know, maybe billions by now, you know, clips on YouTube. Well, a lot in any case. So this is an enormous problem, right? To have a good list so that you would click. And so this is an example where machine learning is being used to try and predict what is the best. Now, the way this is done is not by caring about you, but by basically keeping statistics on people who looked at this clip, typically also looked at that clip. And now what happens is that the people have a tendency, well, this is our weakness, you know, if there is an outrageous thing, they say, oh, really? You know, you look at the clip and then you see Hillary Clinton has a ring of pedophiles in the basement of a pizza restaurant. Say, really? Hillary Clinton? I didn't think that. And you click on it. Okay? But this is sort of, this is used by this machine learning algorithm to say, oh, people are clicking on this. You know, that's an interesting thing to put. So the ranking goes up. And as a consequence, you get all these effects like outrageous things which are fake.
So basically what you are saying is that AI is working on the shadow of our characters.
Well, it's exploiting our weaknesses. Now, it's not that the AI people have been thinking, oh, we are going to exploit people's weaknesses, you know? It just is a side effect. Nobody thought about it before. It was launched, and then you see polarization, you see a rise of racism, you see all these negative effects. And so this is an example where the technology is having an impact on society, for example, also by anonymity and things like that, so that people are saying things which they would otherwise not say.
Hito wants to intervene here.
I just wanted to say, it's not AI as such that wants to do such things, right? You're talking about YouTube. It's YouTube that's programming the algorithm and that's keeping it secret and that's programming in a way to be most useful and profitable to them. So in that sense, I think the question, the technology could do all sorts of different things, right? The technology doesn't have any sort of internal desire to do A or B. It's getting used. It's getting used by corporations. It's getting used by people. So in that sense, I think it would be important not only to ask what language, what alphabet, but whose language, no? Not who has the means of production, but who has the means of translation nowadays. I think that's really important because AI as such doesn't want anything. It's a bunch of statistics, right?
Well, some of AI, yes.
Maybe also you could also focus on the responsibility, because when you say YouTube wants to stay that you are on it, it's that there is a advertising industry that buys the spaces from YouTube. So when we buy a product and this product has bought advertising on YouTube, we are also in a certain way financing this whole system. So I think it would be also interesting in this moment to look at advertising as one of the most interesting points where decisions are taken and where money is fueled and where a kind of network would be but it would be important to read how this system works to understand who is financing this part of research.
That was also something, just very briefly, something I was thinking in relation to what you said, that basically truth claims of language are being undermined now by these fake news and so on, but advertisement has done this for a very long time now, and everyone thinks it's perfectly fine. But I think this is just like radicalized advertisement that's going on now, and that starts, in fact, really to undermine the foundations of societies, but it has precedence already, it has a long tradition.
What for me is a bit scary, but AI is invisible. We cannot see it. We can see a robot, but we know there is, but we cannot see it. And then, going back to Asimov, when Asimov wrote Your Robot, I Robot, he puts rules in these robots. So the question is, which kind of rules we are putting AI of, which kind we should put to have a kind of preservation of our living system?
Well, I should say that there's a lot of attention now going to this topic. And so there's actions from governments, but also the European at the European level, also from researchers themselves, you know, thinking about what are the rules, what can you do and what can you not do, because what we see is that often something is developed in, you know, naively, you could say, in good, you know, not, and then you suddenly see that it's used for creating fake news, and so it's not the AI, let's say these techniques that they are neutral with respect to the usage, but then you see that usage is being made. You know, it's the same with for genetic engineering or for I don't know physics. You know, for making arms. So you can use AI for making weapons, but it's to the people that and to the society that has to create the constraints on how, what is the proper use of these things.
Nevertheless, my question, since you are interested in, let's say, almost philosophical, also in the concept of communication, information, and so on, so my question would be, to which extent, when you describe these processes of the AI interfering in our society, in our minds even, do you also, what are the consequences for the people in this relationship?
Well, I think what we need to do is to understand these effects, because they happened a bit unexpectedly, maybe for some people not unexpectedly, but in general we have to understand them and then counteract them. So it's like with all technologies, we have to learn how to deal with it, that we don't become victims of this technology. But
can you give examples of counteractions to the situation we are in?
Well, they're very simple things, like in computer vision. So there are face recognition algorithms. So maybe you don't want to be recognized everywhere, right? Yeah. You want your privacy. Yeah. Well, for example, you can a countermeasure is that you have a certain glasses, you know, with certain colors on it. And if you use those glasses, then those algorithms don't work anymore.
Yeah.
So this is sort of a guerrilla.
Yeah, do you have some more examples of guerrilla AI?
Well, I think also in terms of your profile, you know, how you change your profile,
yes,
or what profile you create,
yes,
or whether you want to create a profile at all, because the real, you know, you have to become aware that these things are going on by American companies mostly. And so then you can defend yourself. So we have to have a citizen defense against these kinds of developments which are now rolling over us, but we have to counteract.
Okay, I think the time has come that we take questions from the audience. Where do we have the mics? Do we have my
extra mic here?
Here's the extra. You take the extra mic. Yeah. There's the first question here. Giuseppe Longo.
Well, thank you. Perhaps more comments. I've been seeing the work by Luc Stiehls since the 90s in Paris. But what we mentioned before, that these tools are neutral. They are not, because as long as there is no meaning, that's the key issue that Luke has been mentioning very often, they use statistical methods, so they average out. So the advice of Amazon based on averaging out is the only tool they have. This is not true, because it makes us all gray or identical. The advice given by someone in a library that knows your work for a book is radically different, because there is meaning, from the averaging out imposed by tools that have no meaning, thus have to use statistics. So there is no neutrality. There is a commitment on making humanity gray. And that's what we have to counter by constructing meaning. Where I somewhat stress that the originality of your work, Luc, is that you are trying to have meaning embedded in the peculiar bodies and structures of robots, which have nothing to do with our body and structures, because we have embryogenesis, which is differentiation, keeping unit of our organism all along embryogenesis. So for the fetus itself, any heat that arrives, any sound is meaningful. So the organism preserves its unity, it produces organs by differentiation, which is very different the way a robot is constructed. So they will have their own meaning, which has nothing to do. And typically, the origin of language is very different for humans. Human language is born to name things that are not there. Human language is such because we named gods, ancestors that are not there. We gave name to constellations. There's not a lion there. That's our invention. That's nothing to do with giving names to things. So they will have a different history, different frame of meaning, to provide that we know. We can interact in a more sound way. Something was not correct when you mentioned, the first speaker, that we don't know what happens. We know very well. These are very good mathematics. There is very good mathematics now in multilayer networks. There is filtering methods, coevolution methods, nonlinear methods that are implemented in discrete state machine. The rub is that they don't know exactly why. Because the nonlinear methods, the very smart nonlinear methods that my colleague use, convolution with wavelet techniques, very good mathematics, is in continua. Then they need to be implemented in discrete state machines, and they have no correctness analysis. It's a real shame. Let's be honest. They don't know, because they don't know what happens when they implement continuous mathematics of those technologies they have, fantastic, into discrete state machines. You know, there has been 50 years. My first job was assistant professor of numerical analysis. We knew that there is a big issue.
You shut up.
Yeah, so it's false that we don't know. We don't know because there is a lot of publicity well before science. Those guys have excellent mathematics and don't make an analysis of correctness. So cars, automatic device cars, kill people. They killed a woman on a bicycle because there was a chicken walking on the sidewalk because it was not an image named by...
Giuseppe, it's becoming really a bit long.
Okay, because they didn't have that image labeled by an Indian or Chinese guy, because that's what they do. Millions of Chinese and Indian guys are naming images for the purpose of this AI. And then it's a matter of something where the publicity wins over science, and that's a major challenge.
Okay. You would like to react to that?
To be honest, I couldn't understand a word because where we're sitting, we are just in some kind of acoustic hall.
Yeah.
I have a hard time understanding the colleague, so I'm really sorry, but
yeah.
I don't know what you said.
Okay. I think the audience understood better. But I mean, there was one point which I think is quite essential is the distinction between machine language and human language. And would you agree to that?
Of course, yes. I mean, and indeed what is going on is very different from the way humans invented language in the first place. You know, but an airplane is flying in a different way than a bird, right? But it is flying. So they are constructing a communication system. They get better in getting the other to do what they want, or in conveying information. So on a functional level, it's similar, but certainly not, I don't claim that in a way, they also don't learn the way that humans learn language, etc.
Okay. Yeah, I'm Jochen Büchel from Munich. I'm happy that this panel combines video with animism and understanding of artificial intelligence. My question is to Luc Stiels. You are from Barcelona, as I learned. In Barcelona, there's an interesting project running on from your colleague Baños, José Baños at Universidad Pompeu Fabra. He makes films, video films, to teach medical students to understand arts in their research. I think that Europe has a lot of knowledge about organism psychology, like the Ramon Llull exhibition at CCCB. Could you, maybe from Barcelona, connected with Europe, do educational films about this amazing European knowledge about this difference that Ms. Longo said about organisms and artificial intelligence? Could this be a new educational campaign which here at the HKM now starts in a lovely way?
I think we take one more and then...
yeah, good idea, but...
Other questions?
May I ask?
There's a question over there. Perhaps we take 2-3 more questions and
yes.
Then...
Please speak slowly, because for us it's very difficult to understand you. There's
here.
No loudspeakers here, and there's the whole sound. So please speak slowly and get your question.
Please.
Again, a question for Luc Stiels, Elizabeth Sicchiaridi, Hybrid Space Lab Berlin. My question... relates to the video with the robot looking itself in the mirror that I found really amazing, and I would like to ask you to elaborate a bit more on your motivation, questions, and especially what did you learn out of this experiment?
Yes, so the practical problem was, how can a robot learn about its own body? Because, you know, it's a very complicated machine in a way, right? This body. So the robot needs to be able to do that, because if I ask you, raise your left arm, and I don't know, you do this with your head, I mean, how am I going to tell that this is what I wanted from you? So I need to have an image, a body image, of what it looks like to raise your left arm. And so connecting I mean, knowledge of the body means not only to know that which part you have to move, which muscles you have to move, or motors, but also to recognize in the other, you know, what the movement looks like. And so this these experiments with the mirror started by having a way that the robot could look at itself and then do a movement, do something which is called motor babbling in psychology, namely do a movement, and that way kind of figure out what it can do with its body, and then also what it looks like for the other. So, and then this idea of the looking to yourself in the mirror came as a side effect of those experiments.
Okay, we take two or three more questions. There's a question here in front. Or, there's a mic here, yeah. Mic is coming.
Have you seen the series Westworld? Okay. Might be interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I never watch, almost never. Well, never really science fiction because, you know, I'm living it. So.
Yeah, that's another question. Yeah.
I have a question for Hito. At the end of your presentation, you offered to start working on changing the shadow of artificial intelligence to influence the construction of the technique itself. In our times, it's easy to imagine the dystopia of this technology. What are the glimpses of hope and utopia in the socio-technical imaginary that you can see or envision?
This is for the utopian question.
Yeah, it's a bit it's a tough question, especially at this point in time. But I think that actually maybe the solution doesn't really, is not inherent to the technology at all, no? But with the way societies deal with it, try to get a grip on not only what it is maybe even secondary, but what it does and how to counteract some of its effects. And I think that, I mean, you could just start looking at corporations, you know, how much. I mean, these are all very, very simple things. You know, how much power is concentrated with very few technological corporations? Why does this have to be the case? What are the combined effects of lacking taxation, blah, 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 and so on and so on? I think that's really just for starters. For that, there is not even, it's not even necessary to understand in detail how this practically, how these technologies work, because actually quite often, some of them are also not that complicated, but to really look at what they are doing right now and to start acting on that. And I think, frankly, that trying to find political solutions, social solutions, but also really grounded local solutions for these kind of problems, also counteracting the massive urban effects, right? I mean, in Berlin, I don't even want to start mentioning what platforms like Airbnb and so are doing to the cities. They don't even need artificial intelligence already to do that, right? So in that sense, you see, there is a lot of discourse around AI which is puzzled and mesmerized by the possibility of Elon Musk being reborn as singularity and taking over the world. This is usually how these discussions go. You know, everyone is in awe and, oh my God, when is it going to happen? When are robots going to take over the world? And I think to a certain extent they already have, but they look kind of very unassuming and not very threatening, and they are also stupid, but in a way, this is where we should focus, right? Instead of being mesmerized by these icons of AI, which either look cute or terrifying, or, I don't know, something Disney-esque in between, right? But I think this is a kind of distraction.
A
relating to the answer of Hito to this question, are we not in a situation in general where, and look, you described that to some extent, there is, let's say, in the laboratories, creativity going on, and suddenly this is taken over by business models, which are then transforming the reality before there is any space for decision making of people, should we do that or shouldn't we do that? So is technological development just taking over the political space completely?
Yes, to some extent, but this has always happened. I mean, I think like with the car, I don't think there was any time a vote to have the levels of pollution in our cities that we have because of cars and so on, you know. So these technologies, they get developed, and then they always get developed with the idea this will be good for society in some way, and then, yeah, but there are side effects, and so these side effects we have to learn, and then to do something about it. So, like in the case of the car, we say, well, we don't want cars with this pollution, right? But it has taken decades before people started to realize that this was a bad idea. And so I think in that sense, AI is not different from other technologies.
Hito, can we afford 20 more years of time to discuss what are the bad side effects of the developments we are in at the moment?
You know, no, I'm completely, I don't want to answer that question because, you know, I have been training predictive video networks for the past half year, and actually it turns out that they have been training me, you know, instead of the other way around. So I completely refuse to make any prediction anymore.
Okay, we take more two more questions.
Yes, one here.
Yeah, the mic is coming from.
Hello. Hey, thank you so much. I just have a thought. It's not really a question, but maybe some of you can give me insight. So combined with the mister in the front row, the last sentence he said, like, the promotion propaganda, like also as Hito said about advertisement, like the effect of the advertisement has been escalating all this, what happened now, like the result. And I wonder, an event as such, and many events around the technology discussion, is that in a way a demystification of technology, or again can lead into promotion, advertising, and demystifying technology, the importance of technology? And let's say we more focus on the on what's going on in the black box and probably run away from the real issue, that is what's going on and what did it bring to humanity. Like, it's not very clear, but that's what I want to say. Thanks.
Somebody wants to react? No. Another question? Yeah, with more comment. Yeah?
To add one note. What I think is important that we always need to explore and to go on. To research means to study what we are not understanding right now. So I'm not against AI. What is strange for me, because I have also a biological degree and background, that we are creating our competitor because we are in an animal chain, and I think AI is our direct competitor and is not human, or maybe is humanized and it will be also human. So I don't know what it will be, but I think it's always important to explore. So like Ulisse, I think it's important to start to keep what we don't understand.
Yeah, to say something with this, and also what Julia said, I said earlier, you know, there's the pragmatic, practical work in AI. This is what people really do, solving practical problems. But then there's the imagination. And I keep being amazed what people see in AI. I mean, it is like mystical powers. And of course, then this creates a kind of hype. And then after a while, people realize that this is not what AI can do and will not do anytime soon. And then it dies down again. And so there have been cycles before in the history of this field of a sort of winter time, you know, when there was great skepticism and it was impossible to get funding, etc. And then there's again a great hype, and then it goes down again. And so my message would be that, you know, everybody just inform yourself, and of course in education and in the media, the incredible limits to what can be done today. And then the idea, well, in the future this, in the future that. Maybe, but I mean, often this is very far away future, certainly not in my lifetime that I will experience it. So we should just be a little bit more, how should I say, clear in our mind, you know, and not
and
get...
perhaps humble?
No, not get overexcited, but also not underestimated, because you can do a lot of things. So both underestimation and overestimation are bad guides in this whole discussion.
Okay, one last question.
Luke said that AI people and engineers are removed from the social impact of their action. How, since you live on the boundary from what I can understand, what's your opinion on involving them more in this debate and how to do it, and if it's important at all, or if they are somehow impossible to involve and they should just be treated as enemies? Should we, I mean, I'm an engineer, so a machine learning engineer.
Yeah.
And I see around me that it's very hard to explain them what are the consequences. And they still believe in this narrative of engineering as a pure discipline. What are your means to destroy
the
narrative?
Yeah, so the first thing is that, as I said earlier, there's a lot of attention at the moment to this. And so the idea already in several universities, you know, now in the engineering schools and so on, the issue of societal impact is being taken seriously, course material is being developed, processes are, design methodologies are developed where ethical issues are taken into account. And so it's something, I mean, the engineers are smart people, right? And so it's a matter of, they can perfectly, it's a point of view that has to be integrated in the education of the engineers. And this is beginning to happen. And I think within a few years, it will be a normal thing in all educations of computer scientists, engineers, or AI developers. So I'm in that respect, I'm optimistic.
I completely agree with that. I think engineers are actually the groups that are most concerned about, you know, the social impacts, and very many of them very alarmed. And I completely agree that this is a group that actually can produce change because they have the technical and scientific capabilities and should be much more involved in this kind of debate, absolutely. But having said that, maybe one other observation also, because you were saying, asking me about the future, and I said I'm not going to predict anything, but maybe this is the problem, right? Because I think people are also trying to project now the powers of prediction onto any sort of predictive networks and so on, and trying to outsource it again to technology. But this is something which is absolutely crucial, which is a human desire to know about the future, to know about any kind of certainty of what's going to happen, to deal with risk, instability, precarity, and so on, and so on. And this is something
which actually culture has been doing, you know, religion has been doing that. But these powers have now fallen somehow. No one is really taking care of them. This is why basically the idea arises that technology should do it. I think this is something which our sector, which the cultural sector, should be focusing on much more, because this is our job, not technology's job.
Yeah, in German you have this word Geisteswissenschaft. And quite often people who are studying Geistes or are professor in Geisteswissenschaft, they are normally reading books and analyzing Goethe and Schiller. They should really look where the Geist is schaffen heute, arbeitet heute, und der arbeitet heute wirklich in der
Well, really, there's so much in technology and we are not using the potential. We are not training those studying humanities in dealing with technology, and vice versa. We don't teach the technicians enough about the humanities so that they also have the tools, the conceptual tools. I think here we need to rethink the whole education system. Having said this, I'd like to mention that we are going to continue at 5:30 right here in this room. And there we'd like to talk about the crisis of epistemology, is the crisis of information and communication. Felix Stalder will give a lecture. And then we are going to have Gerard Paglen and Mrs. Crawford to discuss all those issues that we started discussing here, and they will provide a more in-depth view. We will now have a short break, and let me remind you, we are going to be back at 5:30, and I also would like to thank our panelists.